So welcome to the show, Joseph.
Well, thanks for having me back on, Whitley. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, well, I'm so glad because, boy, I mean, this is absolutely something, this book. Now, I have been struggling in my mind about where to begin because I think the best place is probably to begin by talking about what is very, very obvious, that we have lost a high and extraordinary science that dates, well, where do you think it dates from?
Well, that's really a very, very profound question. And as far as I can tell and trace in the book, it really goes back to one of two places. That would be Egypt and ancient China. And as you know, I kind of take the approach that as far as the science of alchemy goes, I think really what we're looking at, Whitley, is a legacy of a real existent lost science that existed in prehistorical times in a very high civilization, of which Egypt and China would be legacies.
Legacies, exactly.
But I think in Egypt's case, we're looking at something a little bit more than just merely a legacy. I do think they managed somehow to preserve in some of their texts, and I'm thinking primarily of the Hermetica and associated texts that are very similar to that, of this idea that the physical medium itself creates information, and that out of this, of course, comes creation itself, the diversity
right.
that we see. And as far as the alchemists are concerned, I spend a great deal of time in the book examining some of the alchemical texts, kind of tie down that idea and make that connection.
Joseph, if I may just pause for a moment here, and I hate to interrupt my guests. I have to tell you that, folks, I've noticed I've done it. But for a reason. There is an obscure corner of physics
yes.
called Physics from Fisher Information. You may not be familiar with it, Joseph.
No, I'm not.
Well, Physics from Fisher Information is essentially alchemy. It's the physics of alchemy.
Huh.
Exactly what you're talking about, re-expressed in the terms of modern physics. It's most extraordinary. And, of course, I was riveted when I realized that alchemy, what Physics from Fisher Information says is there is information underlying everything.
Yes.
And that ultimately some process that the quantum physicists believe it may be perception itself causes this information to reality to assemble into the forms that are in this information.
Right, right.
Oh, very familiar to you, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is exactly what you find in the alchemical texts. Over and over again, they stress the idea that that timing is so essential to the performance of any alchemical experiment. And if you really look at what they're saying is that the geometry of local space, which is nothing but information, really, if you look at it in a certain way, that this is essential to the performance of a successful alchemical transmutation. So really what you have, if you look at these ancient texts in that kind of modern physics light, which I try and do in the book, is you have really the adumbrations of as you say, a lost science that somehow manages to get preserved for literally millennia.
Yes.
And I think to a certain extent, and that's what most of the book is about, I think to a certain extent that in the very early 20th century, you begin to see scientists taking this very seriously. In fact, you know, I go all the way back to my book, SS Brotherhood of the Bell, that you have no less than a Nobel laureate physicist by the name of Walter Gerlach writing an article in a German newspaper that, well, you know, alchemy is now a practically feasible thing because they're
right.
looking at these transmutations that they're observing in the laboratory. And I should stress something that struck me very odd, and it still does. When they're talking about these transmutations, he's writing this article in the 1920s. So this is before we have the idea of transmutation in the standard sense of nuclear fission by neutron bombardment. They're looking at something very different and observing something very different. So, you know, to tie it into with alchemy, as he does, to me is just a little signal that somebody somewhere very early on in the 20th century got the clue probably from these observations, that they tied it to these ancient texts. And that is the signal to me that very serious work started to be done during the 1920s. And I kind of document that in the book as well.
Yes.
That very serious work was being done by Japanese physicists, German physicists, and so on. And there were even patents taken out for some of these transmutation processes by firms like Siemens, you know, which is hardly a fly-by-night company.
Right.
So, you know, it is an extraordinary story, and as you say, trying to make alchemy clear is needless to say, is a hard proposition, because these alchemical texts are so bizarrely obfuscated, and intentionally so. I think that these alchemists realized that they had possession of a great deal of legacy from this lost science, and that they were trying to protect it.
Well, this critical word, protect,
yes.
this is if there is an underlying theme, sub-theme in your book, it is that this is a science that is known,
yes.
That is so powerful that basically anyone in any authority who comes across it wants to conceal it. Would that be accurate?
Oh, yes, absolutely so. I mean, you know, you can only read just the smattering of alchemical texts that I have in the book, and there are so many, you know, that I could have put in there. But over and over again, Whitley, one of the things that I was constantly brushing up against is that they took such pains to obfuscate their language and to protect something that they knew was an extraordinary secret. And I think part of the reason for that is if indeed these alchemists had some sort of legacy that they were trying to preserve of being able to manipulate or engineer the physical medium directly.
Yes.
And to use it to transform and transmutate elements, that they also knew that there was a potential there for misuse and for application, let's say, in evil and destructive ways. And I think this is the reason for their concern.
Well, you know, there is a description of the use of this. And what we're referring to scientifically is really the manipulation of so-called Fisher information, what physicists call Fisher information, the manipulation of the fundamental information that makes up reality.
Right.
And somebody's already done this. It's one of the most famous events in history. It's called Genesis.
Yes, exactly.
So
exactly.
When the word was spoken, and the God moved upon the face of the waters, this is a description of consciousness moving upon this fundamental underlying information. And do you think there is some kind of deep spiritual reticence that if we were to touch this, we would in effect usurp the power of God? And we know on some level that is, or maybe some kind of mind control prevents us from doing that. Where do you go with that?
Well, that really is a profound insight, and I have to agree with you wholeheartedly, Whitley, because really alchemy, if you go back to its Egyptian origins and to this idea that the physical medium itself is an information-creating medium, then yes, what you're dealing with quite literally is the power of creation itself. And of course, again, that implies its opposite, that you have an ultimate power for nullification as well. And I do think that there is a spiritual component to this. I mean, my word, you have only to read some of these alchemical texts to...
Yes.
And I cite Paracelsus, you know, who happens...
Extensively, yeah. A wonderful, fascinating, and deeply powerful mind, and also kind of a hilarious guy.
Oh, yeah, he was. I mean, he certainly had a sense of humor, you know, adopting all the names for himself that he adopted.
Yes. Why don't you just, can you reel off Paracelsus's?
I think it's something like Philippus Agricola Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim.
I think it's the exact name. And only the first and last names were real.
Yes, exactly. Philippus von Hohenheim. And he adopted all of these other names for himself, you know, and I think there's a little humor involved in his adaptation of Bombastus and taking that to himself. But I think you have, with these medieval and Renaissance alchemists, you certainly have the perception that this is a spiritual phenomenon. In other words, this is part of the reason, as you say, for protecting this secret, because they realize that they are dealing with, to a certain extent, the power of Genesis itself, this idea that there is a supreme intelligence that moved over the void that we call the physical medium and created this information that we call creation. So any tampering with that, any human intrusion into that process has also, for the alchemists, an esoteric component, because over and over again they stress that in order for a proper transmutation to take place, the alchemist himself must be transformed. In other words, they're not to enter into this lightly. They are to purify their soul and so on and so forth. So yes, there is a definite spiritual component to this, and I think that in terms of its relationship to modern sciences, it's a rather profound one, because you see the alchemists having a rather different attitude towards their manipulation of this medium than does a modern scientist. They don't go about this work lightly, and they don't perform it lightly. They undertake certain exercises to purify themselves before they do so. And, you know, we'd be hard-pressed to find, you know, a modern particle physicist saying a prayer before he does anything, does anything like that. So, yeah, you're dealing with something that's very, very spiritual.
And on that note, we're going to have to take a little bitty break here. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about some actual transmutations in the past, because they did this. And then we're going to be talking about the much darker, and I do mean darker, material that has to do with the present, the future. And I'm going to be consulting with Joseph about high-speed spin UFOs and some of my own personal experiences. We'll be right back.
Dreamland subscribers, don't miss the live chat with Whitley and Ann Strieber in the Unknown Country chat room next Wednesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time.
Also on Saturday, August the 15th, from 9 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time, Joseph Farrell will be chatting live in the unknowncountry.com chat room. Don't miss that one, folks. Obviously, it's going to be terrific.
You're listening to Dreamland. Serious wonder spoken here.
This is Whitley Strieber. I'm talking to Joseph Farrell, the author of The Philosopher's Stone, I believe to be the finest book on alchemy that has been written in years, and one of the few, I mean very, very few, that actually makes this incredibly important part of our history and our lives today one of the most hidden realities in the world and one of the most powerful, makes it real, makes it understandable. The Philosopher's Stone. Wow. Joseph, before we left the air, you just touched on, sort of laughingly, the fact that a physicist in modern times and someone working on this perhaps behind the scenes would never attempt to purify themselves, or if they are working secretly, of course, they can't purify themselves.
Right.
It's impossible. That's why they can get nowhere. By the way, if you're listening from NASA or somewhere where they are working on this and you're thinking we don't get anywhere, the reason is you're starting out from a dark, evil position. You can't succeed.
Right, right.
So tell us exactly what purification means.
Well, to most of these medieval alchemists, and that's where most of these alchemical texts come from, although the ones from Egypt also indicate certain processes. But for most of the medieval alchemists, we have to remember that, number one, they're for, by and large, Christian. And the way they're looking at it is that this information-creating medium is literally the power of God. And therefore, you'll find many of these medieval alchemists invoking the Holy Spirit or invoking Christ himself to purify them, to purge away any element of darkness or stain on their soul before they do their transmutation experiments. And this is something I find totally lacking, and of course, in the modern materialistic scientific worldview. But for the medieval alchemist, it's important to remember that this physical medium itself is a manifestation of God. It's a manifestation, as you pointed out rightly, is a manifestation of the power of Genesis itself, the power of creation. And it's the same thing, incidentally, for the ancient Egyptians. It's
yes.
really a manifestation of the creative power of whoever it was that created the universe.
So it's not like manipulating an unconscious material like it
right.
would be to carve a stone or do
right.
do chemistry at DuPont.
Right.
This is directly addressing like almost the flesh of being, like how do we define God? I mean, it's conscious. In other words, it knows you're there.
Right, and this is an important thing. You mentioned flesh, and over again in the medieval
alchemy. Yeah, I did on purpose, as you know.
Yes, I know you did. As you know, in most of the medieval alchemical works, they compare very deliberately what they're doing to the analogy of the soul's basic incarnation in flesh, or even in some cases with the direct incarnation of Christ himself. So in other words, to them, it is directly a manifestation of this deliberate mind over matter mentality that you find so prevalent in these alchemical texts, that you find so prevalent in the ancient Egyptian texts, and so on and so forth. So again, it is not a process that these people are undertaking lightly, and they do realize the full spiritual ramifications of what they're doing, unlike a modern scientist. And again, part of this, as you say, is that they do view, in a certain sense, in a certain kind of analogical, metaphorical way, they do view the universe as being alive in a certain
yes.
sense. In other words, it's not so much that the universe or a rock, so to say, has consciousness, but rather that it is a visible, tangible manifestation of the will of God, of the
right.
creative will of God. And therefore,
well, everything is.
Yeah, everything is. And therefore, they have to approach this process with this spiritual attitude that what they're doing is, in a certain sense, to kind of paraphrase St. Paul for a moment, they're in a certain sense kind of co-workers with
yes.
God in this process.
And you know, Joseph, just to go, now that we're touching on this whole subject
mm-hmm.
of God, just briefly,
mm-hmm.
We have in our culture a catastrophically strangled image of God.
Oh yes, absolutely. No argument.
And
there
comes in this book, folks, you come to a new vision of God that is vividly real and far closer to what is and must be there. Could you expand on this, on a little bit on this different vision of God?
Well, there, it's really, you know, as you know, my background is in theology, and
right.
The real thing that I noticed over and over again in reading these alchemical texts is that what they're dealing with is not a kind of deistic God. In other words, they're not dealing with a watchmaker who's winding up the universe and then letting it go and run down. What they're rather dealing with is a God whose creative activity is at each and every moment operative. In other words, for the medieval alchemist, every moment of life, every moment of consciousness is sustained by the active participation of the will of God. And therefore, again, you know, when they're doing these transmutations, they understand that they are, in a certain sense, entering into that process of God's will. And therefore, again, they have to purify themselves or to make themselves condign or in agreement with God's will. So it's a very, very different, it's such a completely breathtakingly different worldview that they
yes.
have than,
yes.
than what we as moderns have of the vision of God, of his activity, and of his involvement in seemingly minute little affairs, you know, that that we just take for granted, you know. And this, it is, Whitley, as you say, it is it's a breathtaking vision when you get right down to it. The idea, you know, if you can have the conscious thought that at this very moment, my life, my breath, my being, my existence, my will, my emotions, all of these things are being held together quite literally by the sustaining will of God.
Yes.
And, you know, this again kind of humbles one, and I think that if you read alchemical texts with a view to kind of being aware of this humility, it seems in a certain sense that they have kind of the opposite view, that they really are rather prideful people and yeah, we're able to do all of this and so on and so forth. But I think it's if you read carefully enough at what they're really dealing with and what they're really implying about God is that their view is really the opposite. They are rather humble people. And I think you find that kind of expressed in humorous fashion by all of Paracelsus's names.
Yes.
Because, you know, he himself, as I point out in the book in his text, he does have a very interesting spiritual take on things. He even has his own kind of alternative vision or view of history and prehistory and what has happened and gone on. So, yeah, these people have a profoundly spiritual and intellectual view, and I think it's a rather holistic one if you really kind of penetrate to the heart of their vision.
Exactly, and it's potent.
Oh yes,
in the sense that it may actually cause a response. In fact, has done so.
Right.
In other words, some of them were astonishingly successful folks. They did transmute base metal into gold, but it wasn't because necessarily, or rather I should say only, because of the confections that they created,
right,
but also because of their relationship to the consciousness that opened the gate for them,
right,
to this higher lost science.
Right.
That once was the science of this world. And when we get back, we're going to ask Joseph, why did we lose it? We'll be right back.
This is Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. We go deeper.
Joseph Farrell, the author of The Philosopher's Stone, Alchemy and the Secret Research for Exotic Matter. Best book on this subject I have ever read. Available from Feral House Publishers. You can get it probably in your bookstore. You can order it. You can get it from unknowncountry.com's Amazon store. This is serious reading. This is life-changing, transformative reading. I wouldn't miss this. I would not miss this. Now, Joseph, let's talk a little bit about some of the people, including Frederick, I believe it was Frederick the Great, is that correct?
Well, yeah, basically all of those medieval and crowned heads of Europe, Renaissance, and then even Enlightenment crowned heads of Europe. One of the most interesting people that I found involved in this alchemical stuff was King Charles the 12th of Sweden.
And here, you folks, we're talking about an alchemical transformation upon which a man's life depended. Could you tell us the story?
Well, you know, I ran across this story about a Swedish general by the name of von Pichel. And he was a Swedish general that had been tried for treason and found guilty and sentenced to death by the court of King Charles the 12th of Sweden. And of course, at this point in history, Sweden is at the height of her power. I mean, she's considered a world power, and King Charles the 12th is certainly not the sort of king that you would think of as being associated with alchemy at all. But in the course of reading about this story, this Swedish general claimed that he could perform an alchemical transmutation, that he could transmute base metals into gold. And he offered to do so in exchange for his life. And of course, Charles, thinking probably that you know, this was so much nonsense, decided, well, we'll humor the man and go ahead with this experiment. So Charles has this man perform a transmutation under the watchful eye the British artillery general, no less. And this is performed in his court, and lo and behold, sure enough, the man was able, apparently, to do this. He actually transmuted some lead into some gold.
And exactly how did he do it?
Well, this is unknown. This is unknown, but he claimed to have learned the secret, as I recall the story, from a Corinthian priest or something of that sort.
That's right. That's right. I know more about your book than you do, right?
Probably.
Of course, I just read it. I mean, to be fair, but yes, it was a Corinthian priest.
Well, you know, this indicates to me again that probably this Swedish general had some sort of contact with these alchemists who had preserved this science through the Middle Ages and so on and so forth. Because again, that little hint of the Corinthian priest is the suggestion that these alchemists do have this spiritual component at work in their activity. But in any case, apparently this transmutation was successful, and King Charles XII actually had coins and a medallion struck out of this gold. So you find episodes like this occurring, much to my surprise, after the Renaissance. In other words, when we begin to get this Enlightenment attitude and mentality starting to pop up after the Renaissance, that the universe is a big machine and
yes,
so on and so forth, and really there's no spiritual process at work here.
You know, of course, what this is should be called. Our age should be called the age of the descent into the machine.
Yes, I agree.
Folks, we have lost so much. We've gone soul blind and God blind,
yes,
as we have descended. We did not invent machine. We did not capture machines and invent machines. Machines have captured us.
Yes, that's right. I agree. I agree wholeheartedly.
Well, but let me ask you this.
Uh-huh.
You mentioned these medallions that were struck. Are mm-hmm. any of these medallions still in existence?
That I don't know, but I suspect that some of them are. And one reason I do is that we have similar tales, and I mentioned those in the book. We have
yes.
similar tales of transformations being done for the Habsburg court.
Right.
And given the fact that the Habsburgs are rather, you know, tight-fisted with things that are part of the family heirlooms and so on and so forth, I would rather imagine that some of these things probably do still exist, at least in Austria.
Well, the Habsburgs have, you know, they are so tight-fisted. You know, the Habsburgs still have a gigantic medieval armory filled with thousands
yes.
and thousands of suits of armor.
Yes.
They're ready.
Oh, yeah.
Want them back? They're coming. They've got it. They've got everything ready. They haven't lost a thing. Now, but, you know, this also gets me to another issue.
Mm-hmm.
Certain monarchies
right.
in Europe were very wealthy.
Yes.
Others were not. The Habsburgs rarely lacked for gold, whereas the French kingdom, in
right.
which you see no evidence of any of this,
right.
did all the time.
Right.
So
right.
could it be that they were secretly transmuting metal, base metal into gold?
Oh, I definitely think so. You have at least two instances that I was able to find and mentioned in the book where you have alchemical transformations that were allegedly successful being performed for the Habsburg court. And I rather imagine that the Habsburgs, being the Habsburgs, probably kept a very secretive interest in this all along. So, yeah, that would not surprise me. And again, you mentioned various monarchies. It's interesting to me, Whitley, that the English monarchy was also involved in some of this.
Yes.
So, you know,
another long-lived, successful
exactly,
monarchy.
Exactly. And I think part of the story really is that these monarchies, to a certain extent, are trying to do an end run around what also is beginning to happen that I don't mention in the book, but it certainly is part of the story, that you have at this period in history also the emergence of private monopoly on the creation of money. And of
yes.
course, all of this in that time is based on the gold standard. So, yeah, you have these monarchies, I think, showing an interest in this for their own political reasons, that they're trying to break the hold of that monopoly, and they're turning to the other part of the financial alchemy story, and that is direct alchemy and the transmutation
right.
of base metals into gold. So, yes, I think this is a very intricate detailed story, and I'm doing a new book where I'm going into that aspect of the story a little bit. So, yeah, it's all a very, very interesting, intricately intertwined story.
Joseph Farrell, a writer intelligent enough, and to say the least, brilliantly educated at Oxford, who is able, therefore, to get under the surface of our world and find and explore realities, the realities on which it is based. Joseph, you could have done a lot of things in your life besides essentially going into what to the average person, the average academician, the average scientist, looks like a misguided, hopeless backwater, a labyrinth of confusion and wasted time.
Right.
Why do you do it?
Well, I think, Whitley, part of it is because I've always had an interest in this, but I think, secondly, that there is a real story there. I think the standard academic line about these things is really just missing the mark, and you do have to consider the fact that this, and I put it precisely this way in the book, that the persisting problem of alchemy is precisely its persistence.
Why? Yes, exactly.
Why over the centuries, if we have the presumed mountain of failures that alchemy supposedly, as a pseudoscientist, provided, why then do we have its persistence? And my conclusion is that people then were no less rational than people today, that if they were faced with this increasing mountain of data of so-called failures, they probably would have given up the pursuit of it long ago. But they didn't. And quite the reverse is true, that you do have in the historical record these claims of occasional successes, and that to me has to be taken seriously. And I think, again, when you get into the modern physics aspects behind it, that it is possible that they actually did do this, and may have done it more or less by accident, but nonetheless that they did it. So that points to me, again, what the alchemists had always claimed, that they were pursuing and preserving a lost science. So, yeah, I think we do have to take these things seriously and examine them and try to rationalize them as seriously as we can on the basis of our modern scientific knowledge.
Because there was once immense power, immense engineering power in this world. We can see it in the Great Pyramid.
Absolutely.
In the platform at Baalbek, at the fortress at Sacsahuaman.
Right.
We can see deeply profoundly lost knowledge in the fact that a great number of sacred sites all lie on the same exact parallel all around the world.
Yes.
And we don't know why anymore.
Right.
We're going to take a little break now, and when we're going to come back, we're going to talk about what might have happened. Joseph has dealt with this also in other books, but what might have happened in the past? What have we lost? My God, we're drifting helplessly toward the end of the world, locked like slaves into a mechanistic vision that is disempowering us and rendering us helpless before a tidal wave of change. We're going to get back. We're going to talk about that. And for subscribers, Joseph and I are going to go beyond this. We're going to be talking about the survival of this white powder gold. We're going to be talking about spin, high speed spin, what it means, what it may mean, and how close some of us may be coming to regaining the lost power of the human soul. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland Online.
We're back with Joseph Farrell, the author of The Philosopher's Stone, Alchemy and the Secret Search for Exotic Matter, a brilliant tour de force of insight that can revise the way you see the world and reality and help you re-empower yourself as a human being and as part of this universe. It's an extraordinary achievement. Joseph Farrell, when we left the air, we were just about to start talking about what happened. Why have we lost this? What have we lost? Joseph, what happened in the past to this species?
Well, I get into that in a book of mine called Cosmic War, but in a nutshell, I think what happened was that this very sophisticated, extremely ancient, I call it paleo-ancient, a kind of a redundant term to indicate that it is a civilization that predated Egypt and China and all the classical civilizations that we're aware of. In other words, they were all legacies of something much higher and much more sophisticated. But I think what happened, if we take the ancient epics, the Hindu epics, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana and the Sumerian epics, and even if you read certain Egyptian texts with a certain eye, the Edfu texts, for example, I think what happened was, as those texts indicate, a tremendous war was fought. And as a result of this, there was such destruction and such damage to the infrastructure of that society that it lost the ability to maintain its high pitch of scientific and technological achievement. But as it began to enter this period of decline, I think what they did very deliberately, Whitley, was that they came up with a mechanism or a means of preserving as much of that knowledge as they could. And I think that this is the real reason that you see almost worldwide an almost simultaneous emergence of various mystery schools and religions and so on and so forth that have, as you pointed out prior to the break, so many common elements, including the idea that their sacred sites and temples and so on had to be located at certain points or positions on the surface of the globe.
Yes.
And to incorporate certain mathematical and geometric relationships.
And to connect some kind of, to connect them with some kind of link,
yes,
an energetic link between, yes, the planet and the universe around it, or the solar system, or the sun. We don't know.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's absolutely correct. And in fact, I think that there is a sound physics basis for the reasons that they did this. And I think, again, gradually we are recovering some of these actual scientific reasons that they were located in some of these places. But this essentially is what I think happened. And I think as a result of this, they created this, what I like to call a multi-leveled unitary intention of symbol. In other words, if you look at these ancient mythologies and mystery schools and so on, you will find encoded a lost astronomy, as Lockyer pointed out. You will find,
yes,
encoded a lost sacred geometry, mathematics, and so on and so forth. That, again, at some point, as they probably knew, when humanity began to reach a similar pitch of scientific development, those codes and symbols could be cracked and literally decoded. So again, I think that they took these steps, and alchemy, as I'm kind of casting it in this context, alchemy is precisely one of these sciences, or one of these crafts, to use their own term, that consciously and deliberately was a mechanism both of its preservation and also of its recovery. And that's exactly the way these alchemical texts read. They read both as preservation and very deliberately as a recovery of this science.
As a recovery, but of course, we don't live by this science at all.
No, we don't.
We don't.
And, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned something, and I kind of wanted to comment about it. You mentioned this descent into the machine and
yes,
to the idea that we are being enslaved by it. And I couldn't agree more, because one of the things that strikes me very, very odd and very peculiar is this constant alchemical stress that the alchemist himself, so to speak, is a part of the experiment. Okay? This,
yes,
is their reason for the purification and so on and so forth that they attempt to undertake. But we don't really, Whitley, see a recovery of this attitude in modern science until quantum mechanics.
When you say attitude, could you define that term precisely?
Well, the attitude that the scientist himself is a conscious and deliberate part of the,
yes,
experiment, and therefore that as such, he is determining the results of the experiment. And you don't really find that attitude formally expressed in modern science
right.
until the rise of quantum mechanics.
Yes, and then suddenly you do.
And then suddenly you do, precisely. So again, these alchemists, in a certain sense, if you look at it with these kind of spectacles, the alchemists are really ahead of the game, centuries ahead of the game in
right.
a certain sense. And they're recovering just barely in modern science this idea now that scientists are part of this information-creating medium, of this information-creating network that modern physics has become. So again, the alchemists are in a certain sense profound in their awareness of some of these attitudes and implications.
And they have, there's a lot of power, but it seems so hidden that it's easy to say, well, it's hidden because they weren't anything but just sleight of hand magicians.
Well, yeah, it seems that way. But over and over again, Whitley, when you read these alchemical texts, there are certain parallels. They do give you enough hints, for example, of the color sequence, and this I found very interesting.
Yes, that was the next, oddly enough, you're psychic. That's my next question. My next question was going to be a question about about what they did. But go ahead, that's a perfect way to start.
Well, what they did was, one of the things that over and over pops out in these alchemical texts, particularly from the Middle Ages, is that they record a certain sequence of colors that will indicate that you're on the road to a successful transmutation. And there are slight variations between these color sequences, but they always end with one of two colors. They will end either with white, or they will end with kind of a reddish maroon violet color. And the stage immediately preceding that, they will call the raven's head or the crow, in other words, indicating the color black. So you have a detailed sequence of these colors that are supposed to indicate that you're on the road to a successful transformation.
You know, I know a lot about Mayan and Aztec
mm-hmm.
Religious mythology.
Mm-hmm.
Like so many of the old gods, the Mayan gods were no different. They are expressions of scientific principles
mm-hmm.
That are... perhaps were worshipped as gods by the common people, but of the old science, of this
right.
super conscious science that we have lost. But the religious activities that surround these principles are about addressing the deity in the way that we have been discussing, so that you would be a purified
right.
Acolyte is a word, the deity, the principle, that is to say, which is a conscious living thing, would be willing to work with you.
Right.
And that's what all of this ancient religion comes from. And unfortunately, in the case of Middle America, Mesoamerica, because of the constant starvation problems they were having, it gradually became very brutal. But in any case, you mentioned black. And there is a constant dance between colors
yes.
in these among these deities, black, red, blue, and so forth. So we're looking there at a distant memory of the real power of alchemy. Why colors?
Well, again, we get into kind of a bit of modern physics here. I think the colors are significant because, again, if you look at some of the modern alchemical substances, as I like to call them, monatomic gold, red mercury, and so on and so forth, or even the Nazi serum 525.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about all three in the subscriber section, folks.
Okay. Again, you have the colors of these substances described. And what is interesting to me, Whitley, is monatomic gold is white. It is a powdery substance, very, very fine powder. And this is exactly one of the descriptions that you find of a transmutation in alchemical texts into gold. They will describe it as white.
White, yes.
And a powdery substance, which, again, is extremely unusual because you don't think of alchemical transformations in that way. You just think of, you know, touching the Philosopher's Stone to a piece of tin and voila, you get gold.
Right, but it wasn't like that.
It wasn't not like that at all. No, they're talking about something very, very different. So again, this to me indicates that they are centuries ahead of the curve, again,
yes,
for some reason. And that they, because of this, are preserving a real and genuine science. And it's only when we get to modern times, when we find these substances popping up again and documented in the physics literature, that's what really is the curveball.
Right.
When you find these substances popping up again in modern times, the parallel...
Quite incredibly, by the way.
And incredibly, yes.
And in some cases, quite frighteningly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
It is. It is, because, you know, Nazis and Soviets are not after this stuff for beneficial or humanitarian reasons.
I don't think it's clear that we are either, though.
Because that's true.
Anyone who hides this the way they're hiding it has got to be, it's scary. Okay, we have come to the end of our time together on Dreamland. And folks, if you are a subscriber to Unknown Country, don't miss what we're going to be talking about next.